Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Pierre Valencia. I say propaganda art, you say Nazi Germany. This is the received opinion which a new book by Jonas Stahl, Propaganda Art in the 21st Century, seeks to re-examine. The book describes and problematizes the relationship between art, propaganda, and democracy, and it offers a theoretical reading of some contemporary cultural and political phenomena as propaganda art. Well, I'm very happy that Jonas Stahl joins me today. Welcome to the show, Jonas.
Thank you.
Well, Jonas, you're a self-professed propaganda artist, and it's quite clear the questions of art's relationship with power and democracy and the ability to propagate such messages has been at the forefront of your interest. But I wonder whether we could start by exploring how you came to view propaganda as a critical lens.
Well, I think my interest in the role of propaganda and art emerged from my own specific experience as a Dutch citizen, in which the role of the state since the post-war period has always been very present when it comes to the production of art through art subsidies, the subsidizing of public art institutions, and it seemed at some point evident to me that working in such a conditions means that there is still an active intervention of the state, an active framing of art and culture as something that benefits the state or the identity of the state, even if this propagandistic relation, so to say, is formulated in terms of art contributes to society, represents diversity, or like these very positivistic terms that emphasize the freedom of artists to express themselves in a society. But exactly this expression of freedom, this idea that art is an expression of freedom, is exactly what benefits democratic states on a propagandistic level to declare themselves free of propaganda. But of course, this happens by subsidizing the very same art that expresses this freedom. So it seemed evident to me that there was still a propagandistic relation, and it occurred to me that it wasn't addressed as such, that when we use the term propaganda, it always seemed to refer to a so-called totalitarian past in which art was instrumentalized by dictatorships, or that if the term is used in our current time, that it refers to countries that are still associated with that age of totalitarianism. So we are very, very easily terms of the term propaganda is used to describe Putin's Russia or Kim Jong-un's North Korea, but it's not used in the same way or at the same scale when it comes to democratic regimes. So that's something that really triggered me, really because of my own experience of being an artist in a context where the state is very active in the production of art and culture, declares it as an expression of freedom, but at the same time, this expression of freedom contributes to the glorification of the idea of liberal democracy as something that is free of propaganda. So this touches, I think, also on the paradox of democratic propaganda. The democratic propaganda aims not to be visible as propaganda, and art plays an important role in that.
I wonder if you could spell out some of the ways in which this kind of propaganda imperative of art has actually manifested itself in your practice, given that in a lot of your work you've been associated with organizations like BAK, BAK Basis für aktuelle Kunst in Utrecht, which examining the relationship between art and politics is part of the key mission.
Well, I mean, for me, it's evident that there's always a relationship between art and power, and whether that power is maybe more financial in nature when we think of the way that art markets drive particular forms of art to be circulated, traded in, to give to make capitalism more beautiful in artist Hitosterol's words. Or if it is an active state intervention, there's always a relationship between art and power. And this is not necessarily a problem. I think it's a problem when this relation becomes obfuscated, when it becomes hidden or declared somehow neutral. And so in the way that the Dutch state seems to consider its continuous investments in art and culture as something neutral, something that they finance, but somehow are not involved in. So I don't consider that as inherently problematic, but it asks the question: with whom, with what kind of powers do we relate ourselves as artists? What kind of power do we help to legitimize and shape into being, and which ones do we oppose? I think looking at these questions from the prism of propaganda studies asks a more fundamental question about the positioning of the artist in relationship to given power structures. But as you mentioned, I work with different contemporary art institutions and museums who share this, let's say, critical perspective of the role of art institutions that want to that aim to overall highlight the economic, financial, ideological conditions from which we produce art, and that believe that an important role that art can have is to contribute to popular imaginaries, popular movements, and that aim to create more egalitarian forms of society, and therefore also more egalitarian forms of art, because these two things cannot be separated from one another.
Well, with that in mind, let's get into the book itself. I think the central point you make right at the outset is that there is something to be gained from considering contemporary art, or at least aspects of contemporary art, as propaganda. And the theoretical apparatus which you deploy for this is inherited from Herman and Chomsky's ideas of manufacturing consent. And this proposes an explanation for a way in which art and media can be part of a propaganda machine without even realizing it.
As you say, the Chomsky-Herman propaganda model that they described in the late 80s in their book Manufacturing Consent is a really crucial part in my own propaganda analysis, because it's one of the few propaganda models, contemporary propaganda models, that applies not only to so-called dictatorships or authoritarian regimes, but predominantly applies to American imperialist capitalist democracy. And that's unique because the whole history of democratic propaganda has been not to appear as propaganda, to create this kind of absolute separation between them, the old totalitarian states, or those remnants that still uphold its heritage. Propaganda belongs to that lineage and not ours. Democracy is democratic because it has freed itself from such totalitarian notions such as propaganda. And Chomsky and Herman, they turn it upside down by showing how dominant media filters, the use of misinformation, control over media and communication infrastructure, the use of what they refer to as the anti-communist filter, which today would probably be referred to as the anti-Islamist filter, a creation of an us versus them binary, us versus them dichotomy, to create common enemies and manufacture a new consent, a new kind of negative social contract through this projected threat on the unity of a nation, of a people, very often driven by white supremacist ideas. And they speak specifically of this propaganda model as a way of analyzing the performance of propaganda. And for me, from an artistic perspective, the term performance became immediately extremely important. And they use it in a very formal sense, like the way a company performs in this or that quarter. So what is the procedural mechanism with which Propaganda operates through various filters to manufacture consent, to create a new normative conception of reality that benefits certain elite stakeholders. But for me, this question of performance immediately relates to form, to the question how power performs as form, through morphology, through a genealogy of form, whether that is infrastructural in the form of city planning, whether it is more traditional forms of communication that we tend to associate with propaganda, such as advertisement campaigns or posters, up until the realm of art and culture as such. So for me, this was where the dual reading of performance as enactment and as bringing into form made for me this propaganda model crucial to use as a basis to analyze contemporary forms of propaganda art.
Before you do get to the contemporary, you offer a rereading of the 20th century art canon using the apparatus which you just developed.
So the book deals mainly with the question of contemporary propaganda art and how forms of contemporary propaganda art operate within in contemporary democratic regimes. But it also has a kind of historical backbone, discussing some examples of modern propaganda art, and also to problematize some of the examples that we tend to think we are more familiar with. So if someone asks today, what is propaganda and where does it come from? Most people will be tempted to equate it with the history of Nazi Germany. Propaganda and the birth of so-called totalitarianism are always almost considered as the same thing. And there already we have to make some important remarks that the first modern propaganda bureau emerged at the beginning of the First World War in the United Kingdom, in the imperial democracy of the United Kingdom. It was known as Wellington House. It operated so secretively that even most MPs were not aware of its existence. It used the all red line colonial cable network that was created to oversee the British colonies as a way to intercept and manipulate information without either the Germans or the Americans even being aware of this process taking place. And this is, of course, the paradigm of democratic propaganda that I was talking about earlier. It operates through invisible filters, as is referenced in the Chomsky and Hermann propaganda model. It needs to operate in a way without the general population even being aware of its existence, not to interrupt the idea or the mythology of freedom that is so inherent to for democracy to maintain its legitimacy. And if we follow the diaries of Adolf Hitler, he himself was convinced that he had lost, that Germany had lost the First World War as a result of what he called the superior propaganda effort of the British. And he and Goebbels would model the propaganda apparatus of the Third Reich after that of the United Kingdom. Now, that is not to say that propaganda in the UK and propaganda in Nazi Germany are somehow the same. It just means they both use propaganda. It means that modern propaganda emerged from modern democracy and not from dictatorship, that democracy as such is inherently implicated in the history of propaganda. And it means that we need to speak of propagandas in the plural, because the imperial democracy of the United Kingdom and Nazi Germany, politically speaking, in terms of what these powers wanted to achieve, was obviously not the same. If they are not the same, that means their propagandas cannot be the same either. The infrastructures, the way they produce propaganda, consume propaganda, disseminate propaganda, cannot be the same. And even if we look more specifically at examples of propaganda art in the context of Nazi Germany, these tend to be more complicated as well. First associations will quickly be with films like propaganda films like Der Ewige Jude by Fritz Hippler, very, very insidious documentary that equates in a kind of faux documentary style Jewish peoples with rats and with vermin. It's like insidious editing that suggests the kind of aggressive colonization that would be an inherent part of the Jewish people, uses very intelligently the kind of supposed neutrality or objectivity of the documentary film language. Or we can think of obvious films like the works of Leni Riefenstahl, the kind of epic representations of the eternal Nazi Germany, gigantic marches, the hyper-aestheticized bodies. These are the overt forms of propaganda, often referred to as white propaganda, propaganda that you see and that you're almost aware of the fact that they are propaganda, that they're trying to achieve something, highly ideologically charged, often very monumental in its features, even though they have their own insidious uses of editing, of narrative building, et cetera, et cetera. But it's important to realize that in the context of Nazi Germany, these forms of overt propaganda were only constituted only about 10% of film production, and that 90% were TV series and epic stories like the Der Große Liebe, The Great Love, one of the blockbuster films of the Third Reich that, that were covert forms of propaganda. So they were not explicitly propagating Nazi ideology. They were stories about great love stories. Of course, the war was always present, but as a kind of backdrop to family quarrels and love stories. And but they helped to naturalize the Nazi regime as a kind of neutral, as a neutral backdrop. They didn't make it explicit. They made it normative. They helped to make it normative. And these were the successful films, the very explicit ideological films. Under the Nazi regime, the only reason, the only way to have an audience was that there was a mandated viewing for Nazi party members. And this, I think, is an important note, because it means that often we tend to look back at periods of Stalinist Russia or Nazi Germany and somehow think, how was it possible that people were not aware of what was communicated to them? Well, the fact that Nazi party members were obliged to view these films meant that they were very aware of the fact that a evident overt propaganda operation was being imposed on them. The success at that time, as it is now, is not this explicit approach, but a much more covert approach in which we normalize particular ideological ideas and hierarchies through so-called entertainment. The more a person believes that they voluntarily consume these ideas and images, the more effective and the more embodied they will turn out to be on the long run.
Well, does that seem to place art in a bit of a double bind in its relationship with power, doesn't it?
If we agree that not every form of power is the same, and that different forms of power generate different propagandas in the plural, that manifest in different forms of art and culture, that also allows to trace next to the more dominant genealogies of propaganda art, the role of art in the imperial democracy of the United Kingdom, where the birth of modern propaganda manifested, you could say, the role of art in the context of dictatorships from Nazi Germany to Stalinist Russia, Stalinist Soviet Union. Then we can also start tracing another history, the role of art in emerging form of powers, or the role of propaganda art in forms of counterpower, from the anti-colonial movements to the civil rights movements, to black liberation, to the feminist movements, to ecological movements. There is, and I try to narrate in the book, a long history of what we could call emancipatory propaganda art or popular propaganda art. That doesn't start from a position of mass manipulation, but considers propaganda and the propagandation of alternative horizons, the propagation of alternative forms of life, alternative forms of social and political and economic organization as a collective endeavor. So we're no longer talking about the propagandist behind the curtain and that manipulates the populace into one position or another, but a propagation that emerges through popular mass movements, for example, in the way that Judith Butler talks about the performative theory of assembly, the process in which people pressured by precarious conditions of life seek for one another on streets and squares. And in their protest, in their coming together, even though that is not a voluntary choice, in the process of coming together, they start to enact through slogans and alternative infrastructures and proposals, new imaginaries of new forms of life. They collectively propagate the alternative to what they are protesting against, whether that is a corrupt financial system, whether that is racial capitalism. And that history of propaganda, I think, is severely under-highlighted, and that has a lot to do with the campaign of the propaganda campaign against propaganda, which manifests for very good reasons, for very understandable reasons, of course, after the Second World War and the dismantling of the Nazi dictatorship. And from that moment onwards, and the origin of the term in the history of democracy, the importance of the term in popular mass movements and emancipatory movements becomes less and less visible because the term becomes so discredited.
So one of the things I'd like to trouble at this point in this parallel between the possibilities open to state propaganda and the propaganda of popular mass movements that you propose is the issue of unequal access to communication infrastructures. In the example of a first modernist propaganda that you bring up, so the British Empire's Wellington House and its network, it strikes me that it is precisely the access to a telegraph cable network that makes this endeavor so successful. By contrast, today's popular movements, such as, say, Occupy or Black Lives Matter, often rely on communication networks that it do not control.
I think the first point that might be important to make is that I don't think that when we speak of propaganda art, that every form of propaganda art is merely the expression, the instrument of a state or of a corporate or of a non-state power, of a corporate power. I think that there is in many cases you will find that propagandas produce particular conditions for the production of art, in shaping power, in shaping a new reality, a new manufacturing, a new consent. But art shapes that form of power just the same. I don't believe that by definition, in every circumstance, art is always merely at the receiving end of a given power, that it has a relative autonomy to interrogate and to challenge dominant powers at the same time to which it might be tied. But to come to your question, the Chomsky and Hermann propaganda model that I work out in the book, they argued propaganda is essentially the performance of power. It's the way in which infrastructures of power, whether that's in the mass media, the military-industrial complex, or culture, how they contribute to constructing a new normative reality, meaning that propaganda is not merely about communication. Propaganda is about reality construction. It's about world-making, you could say. And that opens the question, well, how do different forms of power operate? How do different forms of power perform? How do they translate into form? And I think you make a very good point that in my book I try to show a wide range of examples, the role of the performance of power in relationship to art in the context of the war on terror, alt-right movements, the emergence of the Islamic State, as well as historical examples that we touched upon earlier. But I also include examples from popular mass movements, from the Los Indignados to Occupy to Black Lives Matter, as well as different stateless insurgencies from the Kel-Tamashek insurgency in the northern part of Mali, in the region of the Sahara and the Sahel, as well as the Kurdish revolutionary movement in Rojava, in the northern part of Syria. And of course, the types of infrastructures available to these different forms of power is highly different. And you could say that once we start to analyze propaganda in the relationship to popular mass movements or stateless insurgencies, that they are first of all forms of counter power, that they are resisting towards a form of common oppression. They are not in the position of hegemony. They have not monopolized infrastructures of mass communication and mass manipulation, as is the case in the examples you just gave, like of that of the British Empire. But of course, that doesn't mean that what they represent, that it doesn't mean that they are powerless. And here I try to kind of insist on something that Chomsky and Hermann don't. They say propaganda is the performance of power. They all only look at dominant forms of power, monopolized forms of power. But emerging forms of power are attempting at processes of world making, of new reality construction, of establishing a new consent about around rights, about redistribution of wealth, around colonial reparation. They do represent the power. They are more than counterpower. They build from an insistence on the necessity of establishing new egalitarian life forms. So denying their place in the history of propaganda, I felt was fundamentally wrong. And there's also a more general question that makes it on the research level. When is power established enough to be able to start researching propaganda? Because it would suggest, for example, that insurgent movements And if we think, for example, in the field of the alt-right, whether it's like the so-called armed patriot movements, the Tea Party leading up to the Trumpist and alt-right movements, like in which phase are we allowed to start talking about propaganda? I would say from the moment of insurgence onwards, the insurgence that starts to claim a new, demand a new hegemony over our common reality, from that moment onwards, whether they are yet in power or building towards coming into power, from that moment onwards, propaganda analysis becomes relevant. But obviously, that does also mean to recognize that in analyzing these different propagandas with fundamentally different ideological objectives, expressed in fundamentally different forms of art, we have to acknowledge that they depart from different positions of power. And the scale of power to produce propaganda that is available to the United States is not the same as the scale of power that is available to the revolutionaries, the Kurdish revolutionaries that read the Rojava Autonomous Project. But in both cases, from very different perspectives, I think a propaganda analysis is relevant because it's about understanding the form of the world-making force or the world-making objectives that these very different, often oppositional organizations want to establish.
Well, let's do that then. Let's perform the propaganda analysis on a couple of your examples, which is essentially what you do in the second part of the book, where you start chapter 3 with an account of the United States in the early 2000s and the propaganda of the war on terror, which I think is an uncontroversial type of analysis by now. But an actor that turns up in your narrative, which I think might be a little bit surprising to your readers and our listeners, is the character of Steve Bannon, who you essentially characterize as a propaganda artist.
Yeah, so Steve Bannon is an important case study in the book because he shows how the role of art and the role of artistic imagination can also pre-configure political change. And this comes back to the point I tried to make earlier, that it's not that propaganda art does not always necessarily follow as a purely passive instrumental form and dominant forms of power, that the role of propaganda art can also contribute to inciting new forms of political configurations. Bannon is mainly known as the head of campaign of Trump when he came to power in 2016. His ideological advisor and policy advisor throughout the first year of his presidency, the co-founder of the Breitbart News self-declared home of the alt-right network. This is the kind of Bannon that became the public figure around the ascent of Trump to power. But in the about 20 years preceding that, Bannon developed around 10 different documentary-styled film pamphlets. He calls it a form of kinetic cinema, which, if you trace them from 2004 onwards, when he made his first film, In the Face of Evil, really narrates the configuration that we come to know as Trumpism. In a way, Bannon imagines through his films Trumpism before Trump even comes to the political stage, enters the political stage as a political leader figure. And in 2004, in his first film, In the Face of Evil, it is a story about the fight of Reagan against communism. The argument Bannon makes is the return of evil is a cyclical process. What was once Nazism becomes communism, becomes Islamic terrorism. He ends the film with the attacks of the Twin Towers. He essentially argues the clash of civilization we face is cyclical. Evil returns in every generation, and every generation has a historical duty to reestablish the values of white Christian economic nationalism. And that line of terms, white Christian economic nationalism, that is essentially what becomes Trumpism. And what first is Reagan, the strong leader figure that has to lead this epic battle against corrupt globalists, against cultural Marxists, against Islamic extremists. That becomes later on Sarah Palin, when Bannon makes film pamphlets for different leaders in the Tea Party movement, and that later on turns Trump. Bannon himself refers to Sarah Palin as Trump before Trump, just as I refer to Bannon's work as a cultural imagination, a cultural configuration of the narrative of Trumpism before Trump comes to the stage. So I think Bannon is a relevant figure, not only to see how he was shaped by different political forces, first paleoconservatism, moving to the Tea Party, moving to Trumpism, but how his work was contributing to each of these movements at the same time, amongst others through his cinematic work, through his so-called kinetic cinema, which he himself says is inspired simultaneously by Leni Riefenstahl, Sergei Eisenstein, and Michael Moore, which immediately also shows a kind of characteristic alt-right signature of using extremely contradictory sources, communist revolutionary art history to Nazi film history to kind of like film history of progressive liberals, to confuse opponents about where Bannon's own position exactly lies. He's in that sense also an orchestrator of narratives, combining sources in such a way that it becomes possible to talk about Riefenstahl because he mentioned it at the same time as its absolute opposite. So there you see also how the language that he uses around his films, around his cultural works, allows to manufacture a new consent, a consent in which references to total war, a term that actually was originated from Goebbels, the propaganda minister of the Third Reich. The notion of total war turns into the permanent clash of civilizations in Bannon's worldview. So we have an example of a role of a propaganda artist, propaganda filmmaker in this case, campaigner, organizer, that pre-configures political change as much as he shapes Trumpism, as much as Trumpism has shaped him.
Well, I think your analysis points to a certain degree of self-awareness, which is on display by actors like Steve Bannon, the Andrew Breitbart, with whom Bannon co-founded Breitbart News, is known for stating that politics is downstream from culture. I wonder, though, whether we could backtrack a little bit to the United States and the war on terror some years earlier and think about the war on terror and the events that lead into it as a set of performances. In as much as 9/11, the attacks of 9/11 could be said to have been a performance for the camera, it appears that many of the state's responses to those events could be said to deploy exactly the same level of awareness of the performativity of their actions.
The performative dimension of the war on terror, which first of all is of course a performance of a military industrial complex that imposes violence through the invasions of Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, with hundreds of thousands of civilian death as a result. It is also performative because at the same time it enforces a particular ideological specter, an ideological set of ideas. And if we look, for example, at some of the work that artist Coco Fusco was developing at the time of the war on terror, she analyzed it very specifically in the context of the performativity of torture. And I don't use the word performative here to, and she doesn't either, to in any form or way undermine what torture means, what it entails, and what it does to another human being. I don't use it in terms of it being fake or a representation or something. It means the performance, the direct application materially, physically, and ideologically. And she analyzed it specifically in the context of Abu Ghraib, of the torture in Abu Ghraib, torture procedures in Guantanamo Bay, and analyzed, for example, the use also of the female body, the female torturer, very consciously towards prisoners that were assumed to represent highly conservative political and religious ideas, that were devout Muslims. And the use of women and sexuality as a form of torture, the use of popular culture, popular music as a form of torture, really weaponizing symbols of liberal capitalist democracy, whether it is a very reductive idea of women and women's sexuality, a very reductive idea of culture. And it's about weaponizing the culture of liberalism. It's about weaponizing the idea of consumer society. And that process of torture that Coco Fusco analyzes, it scripts the ideological ideas that are being imposed and inscribed upon someone's body through it. They went hand in hand, of course, with the declaration of George W. Bush at immediately after the attack on the Twin Towers happened. We have to fight for our ways of life, go out and shop, continue your life as usual. And that was not an innocent statement. That act of shopping that simultaneously operated as a torture instrument in the context of Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo Bay. And I think Coco Fusco analyzes very effectively and very precisely in her work, in her writings, in her own performances, how that process of the ideological performative component of torture plays out. And at the same time, she highlights it, she deconstructs it, she enables through her work a kind of active counter-propaganda that opens up a specter of how, opens up a series of questions about how we could perform our culture differently, how we can disconnect from dominant ideas of dominant values in consumer culture and their weaponization. And resist. And as such, I think it is at the same time a form of popular or counter propaganda. It analyzes propaganda, but it also tries to resist it through its analysis.
Well, the United States is also a site of another case study that you engage with, which is the story of the Black Panthers Party and the role of artist and activist Emory Douglas in the Black Liberation Movement.
Well, Emory Douglas is referenced as the Minister of Culture of the Black Panther Party. And I think in that already there was a very profound understanding within the Black Panther Party about the performativity of statehood. By declaring Emory Douglas a minister and other representatives ministers, they claimed the position in which they were no longer waiting for the white ethno-state, for the white supremacist state to give them some kind of empathic handout. They declared a form of separatism, declared a separate force of power, which of course manifested most visibly in the fact that the Black Panthers was a legitimately armed self-defense movement, but also related to the famous breakfast programs that were organized, their capability of showing to their communities that they were able to redistribute means of living, that they were able to organize their own education, their own self-defense at a time in which the dominant state was, well, not willing to, but in a position of active aggression, continuous active aggression against its Black population, which is a heritage that evidently continues up until the day of today, which makes the history of the Black Panther Party and its culture extremely crucial. Emory Douglas, defined his work continues to be extremely broad. It covers the making of murals, the making of posters. He designed many of the journals and publications for the Black Panthers Party. He organized also cultural educational sessions for children, for young people, for activists. He researched himself very profoundly the work of artists in other liberational movements in Vietnam, in Cuba. And defined art as something that belongs to the gallery of the people, and that was the streets, that was the public space, that was the community, where his art was represented no longer as something that existed as individual property, but as a form of common property, of a common expression, of a common struggle. And his art was informed as much by the struggle as that it tried to contribute to the struggle. So he didn't make this separation that we often find between the artist and the community. The community speaks, and with that, the artist speaks and contributes to the community at large. And of course, Douglas was someone who contributed in a very essential way to creating emancipatory propaganda narratives that helped to understand and visualize common oppressors. And the use of the figure of the pig in his work is probably the most important. The pig represents the policeman. The pig represents the white supremacist authorities. The pig in his work signifies who are common oppressors in order to identify who are we as a people in relationship to who is threatening our common well-being, our collective right to self-determination. So in all of these ways, he contributed both organizationally to the movement. He contributed to redefining what is the meaning of art in a popular mass movement, to who does it belong. All of his art always existed in kind of a mass, either a public form like the mural or a mass produced form like the journal, the poster. And in the process, his work had a purpose as a kind of popular education of repositioning ourselves, de-identifying from the oppressor state, and re-identifying the pigs, and re-identifying with a new collectivity, with an insurgent collectivity, which was the Black Panther Party. And in some sense, you could say the Black Panther Party state.
So I think this is a key point, really, in the trajectory of the book, because you list different ways in which art can really be a contributor to these emancipatory movements. And if I can paraphrase what I think you were just describing in what Emery Douglas was doing, is that by moving art to the Gallery of the People, essentially what he ends up doing is he opens up this kind of representational and communicative possibilities of art. He offers a resource in which the movement can communicate either internally or externally using art, and that is something that's specific to art, to propaganda art in particular, that is not available to those kind of movements. Do you see this playing out in contemporary movements, like, for example, the Occupy movement of 2011?
Of course, it's important to say that when we talk about the work of someone like Emery Douglas as propaganda art, that it's very important to not say that in general, but to say that somehow in specific. In the book, I use the term popular propaganda art to emphasize his relationship to popular mass movements, to emphasize his relationship to a collective propagation compared to elite forms of propagation that are central in war on terror propaganda, for example, or the historical imperialist propaganda of the United Kingdom. I think that what Douglas represents, what his work represents, the way that a popular mass movement creates the conditions for new forms of art to come into being, and that these new forms of art also contribute to shaping and manifesting this new form of power, this insurgent power, that this is an analysis that runs throughout various popular movements and popular revolutions, that whenever new emancipatory forms of power emerged, also fundamentally new ideas of art, to who art belongs, who has a right to make artists, who uses the term artist, who owns art. I think these questions become manifest. In the Occupy movement, I think a powerful example came from Not an Alternative, a collective of artists, climate activists, as well as today many indigenous members, that developed tools for the protest. They made this beautiful Occupy tape, the yellow tape, the tape that was used to foreclose houses that led to the mortgage crisis, as a result of the mortgage crisis that led to Occupy coming into being in the first place. But they made the same yellow tape with the term Occupy to enclose banks. They distributed it amongst activists, enclosed banks, enclosed police headquarters, enclosed the institutions that represent the corrupt institutions at the foundation of the crisis. So here again, you see the use of an artwork, the tape, you could say, as a tool. The artwork becomes a tool. It's a visual form. It's a conceptual form. Using this tape, distributing this tape, using this tape to kind of normally we as protesters, we are delineated. It's the cops that put some kind of tape around us. Now they gave the tape to the protesters, to us, and it gave us agency to delineate, to enclose them, to turn this, to identify a common oppressor and to turn agency. It's not them that have agency over us. Now we have at least an imaginative agency over them. We can foreclose the bank after they foreclosed us. So there's the conceptual language that they contribute, but then it immediately has a practical application in building movement power, in building popular power, in reclaiming a sense of self-dignity, in contributing to a sense of collective force and collective agency. Because that is a crucial component, I think, in every popular movement and every revolutionary movement, the moment where we have to begin to see ourselves not as the counter-force, but as the new force, not as the counter-hegemony, but as those responsible to establish a new hegemony, establish a new normative reality, which, of course, is what the core objective of propaganda is, not just to communicate the message, but to establish new reality, to make new world. And I think art has this, art in this movement. Art doesn't create revolutions. Art doesn't create popular movements. Artists are just one out of many, many workers that contribute to the possibility of building a new normative, not normative reality, to constructing a new reality, a new egalitarian reality. But I think one of its crucial competences in that process, in that contribution, is to place ourselves for a moment with one foot in the world that we want to create and one foot in the world where we are. And this Occupy tape, I think, is a beautiful example of that, because we know that we do not yet have, as protesters in the Occupy movement, we know we don't yet have the power to foreclose the banks, but we will. And we can already visualize how that world will look like. We can already pre-enact that world, and we can already feel the joy of this victory that is not yet real, but already too much imagined to not become reality. So I think art in these contexts can push imagination towards a point where the desire to collectively organize and collectively act to make that imagination a reality, that art can push that process.
It's quite clear, Jonas, even from the tone of your voice here, that this is the part of art's mission and possibilities that you are quite excited about, which I think brings us quite neatly to the vexed question of the artist's relationship with any social movement. And I think it's one that you address in the book in an interesting way by considering the role of propaganda art in a situation where a state, a power actor, doesn't necessarily articulate themselves in a way that we could expect. And the case study on which you expand in this chapter is one that I know you've been involved in quite intimately yourself, and that is the self-governing region of Rojava in northern Syria.
Rojava means west. It refers to the western part of Kurdistan, which, as you said, is located in the northern part of Syria. And in 2012, when the Assad regime was drawn to the south to fight the Islamic State, it left a power vacuum. And the historical people of the region, the Kurds, together with Arab and Syrian allies, reclaimed their territory for the first time and declared it autonomous. So this was in 2012. Syrian civil war was still in full process. And ever since, this autonomous region, this autonomous government, has been threatened and attacked by Islamic State, now through an invasion of the Erdogan regime, of the Turkish regime. But in the meantime, despite all of these external threats, they developed a political project they refer to as stateless democracy, to create a democracy without the state, also in response to the long imperialist history in the region. And their identification or analysis of the state as something that represents inherent patriarchal, nationalist, and capitalist values. So the basic governance model is a kind of decentralized model of self-governance, where the smallest political entities, like communes and municipalities, have more political agency than larger, overarching, coordinating bodies. It would be as if your municipality has more power than your national government. They both exist, but the power investment, the capability of accessing executive power, is fundamentally reversed. And part of that project of trying to redefine what a democracy without the state is or could be, part of that process has been shaped, narrated, visualized by various contemporary artists. A good example is the work of sculptors Abdullah Abdul and Masun Hamo, who have been creating a kind of museum of the stateless. They reconstruct through their sculptures lost and often thieved archaeological heritage, taken either by the French or by the British. They reconstruct their history, and in a way show through this collection of objects, this collection of reconstructed objects, a history of statelessness that far precedes the history of statedness. Their argument is that our existence as stated humans is much far shorter than the long genealogy of pre-Mesopotamian city-states, confederals, matriarchal societies, partially mythological, partially factual. They try to create through their artworks, through this stateless museum, an alternative genealogy of statelessness that actually makes the point, well, this stateless democracy, this stateless revolution of Rojava is not an exception. We continue a heritage that is inherently ingrained in our land, in our culture, in our mythology. And I think that's also an interesting role of an emancipatory propaganda art, that it emancipates our understanding of the kinds of societies that we could live in, that we could create. But in this case, also by employing an alternative historical narrative. So against the reality of a world that is defined by an interstate system, they make they use artistic and cultural means to actually tell an entirely different story, a history in which the leading role of women or of women leaders, a history in which forms of self-governance and confederal forms of self-organization is far outreaches the dominance of the modern nation state. So in that way, there's a very important intersection, I think, in the Rojava context between revolutionary imaginary and artistic imaginary, and we can trace how these two intersect with one another. I have been myself very involved with the movement for a long time through various projects since 2012. So I worked in the region and worked with the autonomous government also myself, apart from being there to interview artists and to do field research that was included in the book that we're discussing today. I was also commissioned to work together with the autonomous government to create a new parliament for the region, a public parliament. The parliament is a public space that would embody both as a kind of monumental construct the core ideas of this project of stateless democracy, but would also be a space where they could be put to practice. So an artwork in the form of a parliament that would not only represent the ideas of stateless democracy, but would also be a site of popular assembly where they can be put into action. So this to highlight my personal stake as a propaganda artist, so to say, in the context of my own research. I'm not neutral in my research, evidently, because my own work has been completely shaped by working with popular movements, pan-European parties, or organizations like the autonomous Rojava government.
Well, if we were to ignore the humanitarian situations in northern Syria, ideas and communities like Rojava do seem to be almost utopian in a kind of proto-artistic way. And I wonder if you could speak a tiny bit more to the role of artists and the continued need for artists in determining, in shaping, and maintaining a community like Rojava. And I think this is important, particularly because you, in some sense, refer to the responsibility or the possibilities of artists to choose the kind of movements for which they perform their propaganda art services, so to speak.
Maybe to start with the first comment that you made in relationship to the almost seemingly utopian reality of the Rojava Autonomous Government. I mean, utopian maybe in the sense of a militant imagination of other worlds, other forms of governance that might be possible. But the material reality of Rojava is, of course, one that is extremely harsh. Every surrounding state has done everything possible to deplete this political project from ever coming fully into being. And it shows the risk and the costs that come when we become part of actual political alternatives, like defending other forms of life in a world that is defined by extractivist, capitalist, imperialist politics comes at life and death. So every achievement, every positive reference and hopeful reference we can make to all that has been created throughout the Rojava Revolution since 2012 comes every step of the way with huge sacrifices and losses of actual lives. In terms of the role of art in that process, in the interviews that I did with artists like Abdullah Abdul and Masoud Hamo that I mentioned, but also the Rojava Film Commune, a collective of filmmakers that educate to produce a new cinema for the Rojava Revolution, produce their own films as well, but also musical groups like Koma Botan. From these interviews, the artists, the cultural workers, always emphasized that for a stateless nation like the Kurds, often referred to as the largest nation without a state in the world, the role of art and culture becomes essential also to maintain the heritage and stories and common narratives that otherwise would be protected and regimented and administered by a state. So being a citizen, a stated citizen, also gives you the well, the privilege, you could say, to outsource your history to common bodies that maintain your collective memory. Whereas the way they described it, even the use of Kurdish language has been criminalized in many countries, like in Turkey, was criminalized for a long time, is still criminalized in many, many forms. So even speaking Kurdish, reading a poem, singing songs, these were the clandestine ways in which the history of language, the history of symbols, the history of common narratives, common struggles could travel as a kind of stateless state up until the moment that it could land, in this case, in the mountains of Bakur in North Kurdistan, where the Kurdish, where the Kurdistan Workers' Party has many territories under their control, or in the context of the Rojava Revolution. Although it is interesting to, of course, and very crucial to emphasize that in that cultural imagination also emerged the idea of an independence beyond statehood, a critique of the state as something that actually undermines people's sovereignty rather than strengthens it. And we find that analysis emerges between political struggle and cultural struggle. These two components cannot be entirely separated from each other. When it comes to your question to being a propaganda artist for hire, I am not for hire in that sense. And indeed, I do believe, and I make the point in the book, that there is for every artist, for every cultural worker, for every worker in that broader sense, there is a political responsibility to decide within which imaginaries of power we decide to be active. I believe power is everywhere, but not every form of power is the same. And we have choices between the different worldings of the world that we can bring about, that we can contribute to bringing about. And that is indeed also part of an individual ethical consideration, even though the process of worlding the world is never an individual one, or at least should never be an individual one. I believe very much in emancipatory propaganda, as I mentioned earlier, as a collective propagation, as a propagation of collective imaginaries, in which artists have a role, but certainly not the only role, alongside many other workers and organizers. And that has shaped my work very much as well. The paradoxical role of being, in a way, a propaganda artist, someone who has a lifelong commitment to various political organizations and groups that I have worked with in the past and will work with in the future, while at the same time, so I explore through my own artistic practice the role of art in relationship to different forms of political powers, because that's the work that I do. And at the same time, I analyze it. I analyze it in relationship to my own practice, but also in relationship to the practice of others. So it puts me in the paradoxical position of being a propaganda artist who is at the same time a kind of semi-historian of propaganda art. But it is as much an embodied experience as a research experience.
Well, Linus, thank you very much for sharing your reflections and observations on your research with us so generously. And I know that you're in a habit of being involved in many quite significant projects at the same time. So I'm wondering whether there's something that we should be looking out for that you are working on right now.
Well, in the context of the pandemic, of course, I've been working also on the role of propaganda in relationship to the pandemic, whether that is the way in which popular films about pandemics or virological breakdowns have influenced the way that we have responded to the pandemic, the way that there was a collective imagination of what a pandemic is, of course, before we actually lived it, because global pandemics have been rehearsed like various global disasters endless time in Hollywood spectacular disaster cinema. And in these films, there's also a kind of prescription of how we expect people to response. Did we genuinely believe that there would be food shortages in the global north, and is that why suddenly there was no toilet paper available for and canned food available for a substantial part of the population, especially care workers, when they would come home after hours and there was nothing left in the supermarket? Like, did we genuinely believe that there was going to be a food shortage, or have we been prescripted through popular narratives in Hollywood spectacular pandemic cinema for so long that we presume that this is how we are supposed to respond? And that counts for the role of war games that are being used for government officials to train them on pandemic responses. It's very interesting to trace how did the history of war games and the kind of scenarios they produce, how did they inform the way that government officials in the pandemic have responded? How much of the world that we are living now, the crisis that we are living now, are we living based on our current experience or based on rehearsed assumptions about how we are supposed to respond to crisis? And what kind of propagations have benefited from this period of the pandemic? Certainly, if we look at the rise of the trillion-dollar company from Amazon to Facebook, and their propagation of mass information, of mass data capture and surveillance, has led to their best quarter numbers ever, meaning that our loss, our crisis, is essentially their capital, the drive of their propagation, also literally in terms of their the expansion of their influence on public life. So much of my work, if we speak about it in relationship to the book, has been related to these questions, and not only in researching them, also in initiating a lawsuit together with human rights lawyer Jan Vermon against Facebook. We call it collectivized Facebook. It's an attempt to charge Facebook through the Human Rights Council in Geneva to charge them for undermining the right to self-determination of people over their own information, over their right to have open and non-manipulated elections, their right to be protected from surveillance, all kinds of capabilities that Facebook has, all kinds of infringements that Facebook is implicated in, and to demand the Human Rights Council to recognize Facebook and other trillion-dollar companies as a form of public domain that should be under the ownership of users. It shouldn't be not a reform of Facebook or of Amazon, and not a nationalization either, a corporatization of platforms that in many cases we have ourselves constructed. We produce the data that is the capital of Facebook. We made it. So we should have a right to own it. We have a right to socialize this social media as we have collectivized or nationalized, made public, made common many private initiatives in the past that disproportionately impact the public well-being. Maybe it's again an example of how I perceive my role as a propaganda artist and a propaganda researcher. I try to trace and map which propaganda narratives have influenced our position in the current pandemic, which propaganda narratives are benefiting from the current pandemic, and at the same time, in this case, with lawyer Jan Vermon, we're also looking at how we can use this moment, the crisis and inequalities this pandemic made visible, to propose alternative propagations, and the propagation of, in this case, turning trillion-dollar companies into cooperative collective property, of fighting our precarization by reclaiming infrastructures that we built, but we were never paid to build them. And now it's time to pay the bill.
Well, the scale and ambition of your project has never failed to amaze me, Jonas. I wish you and all of us all the best in the propaganda and counter-propaganda wars. I'm going to put some links to your collectivized Facebook project in the show notes, and I encourage listeners to explore those. And for now, Jonas, thank you very much for joining me on the New Books Network.
Thank you for the conversation.
Jonas Stahl's Propaganda Art in the 21st Century is out from MIT Press. I'm Pierre de Lancer. Thank you for listening, and join us next time.